I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Roger Stone, a Trump ally, was found guilty of 7 felonies, including lying to Congress, obstructing justice, and tampering with a witness. Judge Amy Berman Jackson sentenced him to more than 3 years in prison this month after Attorney General Barr undercut the prosecutors who had called for more time and who all quit the case. President Trump has tweeted insults aimed at the judge, calling her biased, the prosecutors calling them these corrupt people, even the jury forewoman saying rarely has there been a juror so tainted. We asked Judge Nancy Gertner to join us to talk about some of the legal and constitutional issues raised by these attacks. She served as a U.S. District Court judge in Massachusetts for 17 years, appointed by President Clinton. She's a professor at Harvard Law School. And Judge Gertner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
You know, I was thinking about when Obama criticized Citizens United at the State of the Union in front of some of the justices of the Supreme Court, and people were pretty shocked by that. How unusual is it for a president to be so overtly and so publicly critical of a judge, prosecutors, and members of a jury?
I think you have to sort of parse that out a bit. So criticizing a juror is simply unusual and outrageous. And why is that? Because a juror is a sort of an inadvertent participant in a trial. The juror has none of the protections of a judge. A judge has life tenure. The juror is vulnerable in a way that a judge and the lawyers are really not. So that is outrageous, and I've literally never seen that before. With respect to criticizing the judge, that is also troubling. We've now seen this before with this president, but as I said, it doesn't have the same resonance as criticizing a juror.
Well, it also—I mean, it's hard to know when this all began, but the jury forewoman defended the prosecutors. This gets kind of complicated, and then she got attacked. And what she said: "It pains me to see the DOJ now interfere with the hard work of these prosecutors. They acted with the utmost intelligence, integrity, and respect for our system of justice." So she was then defending the prosecutors, and that's when it seemed the president aimed his attacks at her.
But that's a different, that's really not unusual. In the course of my career as a judge, it was not unusual to get letters from jurors in which they wanted to weigh in on what the sentence should be. It's post-verdict, and they're watching the prosecutors being criticized, and they're coming in and saying, we thought the process was fair. That's not at all unusual. Or where the jurors would say, thank you for doing an appropriate trial and a fair trial. So that's really not unusual. That was not a stunning thing to have said to trigger this kind of reaction. The issue about what she said, what this juror said in her juror questionnaire, mm-hmm. and then what she said on voir dire, those are different issues. Those hark back to the fairness of the underlying trial. What her commentary afterwards really does not.
And there is that whole question. I served on a jury. It was a really fascinating couple of days that I had, but it does raise questions about the kind of objectivity that jurors are asked to have, knowing, of course, that everyone has opinions about most everything, including the president of the United States, whether you're a supporter or a critic. How does the system then decide, when that support or that criticism really goes too far? And I realize these are what the prosecutors and the defense attorneys have to figure out.
Well, it's not just a question of when the criticism goes too far, because, I mean, it's ultimately an adversary system. So the first question is, was she honest in her responses in the juror questionnaire, right? Because you can't, if someone is not honest, that's an entirely different issue. Was she honest in those questions? I believe the relevant question was, did you post material on social media or words to that effect? And the question is whether she acknowledged that she had, but she didn't remember the specific content. Okay. So the question is, was that an honest response? Likewise, during voir dire, what people are missing is that the judge questioned this juror about that questionnaire answer, and the lawyer for Stone never followed up.
Oh.
Let me pause at that. The lawyer for Stone never followed up. The lawyer for Stone never got on social media to see what to match her responses with what was in social media. And the question is what, and in fact, I mean, Judge Jackson at one point during the proceeding said, you didn't ask her any questions. So the issue is not what was she fair in her heart. The issue is whether or not she participated fairly in the process, honest on the initial questionnaire, honest in the voir dire, and then what were the obligations of the lawyers to find out whether she was or she wasn't?
I wonder, though, and the president has been very overt about his criticism of this particular juror, and I kind of kept waiting to hear, is someone from the U.S. Supreme Court going to weigh in on this? Has the response to this very personal attack, has that been as you had expected it?
Well, the attack on the judge, is outrageous. The attack on the judge is outrageous for a couple of reasons. One is that the attack on the judge, by the way, before the sentencing of Roger Stone, is one thing. It's one thing to criticize a judge after you've made a decision, right. And, you know, there are fair criticisms and unfair criticisms, but to criticize mid-proceeding is to seek to affect the outcome, and that's outrageous. That really is a direct sort of challenge to the independence of the judiciary. Now then, to add to that challenge to the judge's response to this juror, again, mid-deliberation, mid-process, mm-hmm. is also outrageous. I think I can't begin to describe to you the supports for the independence of the judiciary is obviously critical. And although I was a judge for 17 years, you did everything you could to focus only on the case in front of you. The more noise there is outside your door, the harder that gets to be. And when that noise is coming from the chief law enforcement officer in the country, it has the potential for devastating consequences. This judge is very strong. I know her well. And, you know, she is someone who can say, this is preposterous, I'm not going to listen to it. But what about the next one and the one after? And likewise with jurors. In the next high-profile case, will there be jurors who will feel, I don't want to participate because I don't want to be hammered by the president or his followers? One of the things you tell jurors is that, will you be able to decide a case in a way, even if it meant you go back to your communities and everyone disagrees? It's not a vote of the community. It's a vote of that juror. And the more the community's views come rattling in, the more difficult it is.
Well, I hear your criticism. And is what the president doing, is it illegal? Is it jury tampering? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just sort of curious about how the law looks at that, or if it does.
Well, I mean, as many things in this administration, I don't think I've ever, nobody's ever had to deal with a situation like this. It would be conceivably jury tampering. The question is, that's a moot point because mm-hmm. no one is about to bring such charges against this president. There are laws about doing things whose purpose is to undermine the administration of justice. But we haven't taken recourse to those kinds of things because nobody has done them. And certainly not someone who isn't a party to the case. Right? You would go, jury tampering is oftentimes those charges are brought against people who are parties to the case, who have an interest in the outcome, not just a general political interest. So, yeah, while this may be wrong, even illegal, there's no recourse against this man.
Well, it's interesting that, and there was a piece, and actually a member of the jury, a guy named Seth Cousins, had a piece in the Washington Post recently where he defended the jury foreperson, saying she expressed skepticism at some of the government's claims and was one of the last people to vote to convict on the charge that took most of our deliberation time. So you've got members of the jury, and they would know, of course, what was happening in that deliberation room, but you've got members of the jury at least defending the jury foreperson.
So there are two issues in that. One is the judge is deciding not only did this juror tell the truth in what she said in her questionnaire, mm-hmm. did she tell the truth in what she said in voir dire, in the questioning in court, but also whether if she misrepresented in any way, whether that was material, whether that made a difference. I mean, if you say you were born on one date and you were born on another, is that big enough deal to strike you from the jury and to cast doubt in the whole deliberation process? So that's one thing. And to the juror coming forward is saying this stuff didn't matter. Hmm. Her actions as a juror were appropriate. That didn't have an impact on the outcome at all. But the second point is it is stunning that they have to justify their decision. We have a general verdict in this country, which means jurors get together and they say guilty or not guilty. Mm-hmm. They don't have to write a decision. They don't have to justify what they do, precisely because we want people to be free to exercise their conscience. To have to justify it now after the fact is really such an undermining of a core aspect of the system. So it's called a general verdict, so you don't have to justify it.
I want to go back to Seth Cousins because he also says, when the president attacks our jury foreperson, he is effectively attacking every American who takes time off of work, arranges childcare, and otherwise disrupts their life temporarily to participate in the civic duty. Of course, the civic duty is to serve on a jury. Are you concerned? You mentioned this earlier, but how concerned are you that this could cast a kind of a pall over jury service?
Well, I think I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned. As it is, it's very difficult in a social media universe to find a fair jury, right? Because we used to talk about pretrial publicity in a case. Now, when there is pretrial publicity, it's extraordinary the amount of material that you see on cable, et cetera, et cetera. So it's already difficult to find jurors who are prepared to disentangle from the internet, who are prepared to disengage from social media, who are prepared to try to be fair. That's already difficult. And now if you add to that the problem of a high-profile case with political ramifications, that's difficult as well. I don't want to be criticized. And then if you add to that now this torrent of criticism coming from the highest chambers in the United States, I mean, that makes it incredibly difficult. And, you know, it's interesting. It'll skew who are the people then who want to put up with that.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think this will blow over, or do you think there's some lasting impact?
Well, I think if it's a one-of, it might blow over. If it's a sustained attack, you know, over and that we see now in other cases, that would be a different issue. I might add that there's a similar question in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing in Boston, where the jurors, there were jurors who said that they, who promised the judge they would not go on social media or join Facebook groups or anything like that, and the lawyers for the marathon bomber went online to test that and found that these jurors had in fact engaged in Facebook groups and had in fact participated online when they told the judge they would not.
I hate to leave it there, but they're playing my song. Judge Nancy Gertner,
okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're
today
very
on Radio
welcome.
Times.
Okay, take care.
Thanks. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. When the New York Times Magazine began publishing the 1619 Project, the response was enthusiastic. Essayists argued that the nation was founded not in 1776 when the colonists declared independence from Britain, but in 1619 when enslaved enslaved Africans were first brought to the British colony. The series explores how slavery and the contributions and sacrifices of Black Americans are, quote, at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. The series has also generated some pushback from some historians, conservatives, even Trotskyists. Our guest, Nicole Hannah-Jones, is the leader of the project and wrote the opening essay. It's about her father's faith in the promise of America in spite of the racism he faced and how enslaved people built America's economy, infrastructure, its wealth, its culture, and have been, quote, perfecters of democracy over the years through resistance and protest. Nicole Hannah-Jones is an award-winning investigative reporter covering race and civil rights for the New York Times Magazine, co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting. She was a MacArthur Fellow in 2016 and joins us from New York. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What inspired this whole project?
The inspiration for the project was the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans being sold into the colony of Virginia. And it just seemed like most Americans had never heard of the year 1619, and it was likely going to pass with very little acknowledgement. And yet this was such a pivotal moment for the America that would come. So much of our institutions, you know, our legal system, our political system, our culture, educational system, so you name it, so much of it has been influenced by that decision to engage in racialized slavery. And yet that's been treated as marginal to our story. So it just felt like a really tremendous opportunity to bring that moment and the foundational role that slavery has played, as well as Black contributions to our nation, to the center of the American story.
And I want to talk about all of that. What do we know, though, about there, as you write, something like 20 to 30 enslaved Africans were brought to, I guess it was Virginia at the time. This is 1619. What do we know about them?
We know very, very little about that first group, and I think that really speaks to the different experience of those who arrived here in bondage versus those who voluntarily immigrated to these shores. This year is also the 400th anniversary of 1620, which is the year the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock on the Mayflower. Every American child learns about the Mayflower, and you can go online right now and find the ship manifest for the Mayflower, and we know the name of every person on that ship. When it came to the White Lion, which was that first ship in August of 1619, we don't even know how many enslaved Africans were on there. John Wolfe said that there were 20 to 30. That's what 20-odd means. We don't know their names. We know almost nothing about them, which really is kind of a perfect metaphor for how we have chosen to obscure the role of slavery as well as the contributions of the descendants of those original 20 to 30.
And when you start the country's founding, as you and others do at 1619, and you look back from 2020, you see for this country, there have been enslaved people longer than there have been free Black people.
Absolutely. And just to be clear, we're making a rhetorical argument.
Right.
You are in Philadelphia. No one is arguing that 1776 doesn't matter. What we're saying is, what would it mean to consider 1619 as an origin story? And how would that help us understand the America that we have today? And what you said is very true. Slavery was practiced on these shores in what would become America and in the United States for 250 years. Black people have been legally free, meaning had full rights of citizenship, only since 1968. So when we look at that timeline and we understand that slavery, the institution of slavery lasted longer than the abolition of slavery in this country, and that the abolition of slavery was followed by 100 years of legalized discrimination and racial terrorism, we shouldn't be that surprised that we still face vast racial inequalities across everything that you can measure in American life, that Black people still face a great deal of discrimination. And so it should not surprise that we're still wrestling with race and racism in this country and the racial inequality that slavery produced.
Let me ask you some personal questions, because you talk about your father. He came from a family of sharecroppers in Mississippi, and he always flew an American flag in the yard. What did that flag mean to him?
So my father joined the tradition of a disproportionate number of black men who joined the military service in hopes that fighting for your country and showing a willingness to serve your country would make your country see you as a man and a full citizen. So my father was a military veteran and had a deep sense of pride in his service and a deep sense of patriotism. And he really felt he had the right to claim this country and its flag. And you know, my father's been gone for several years now, mm-hmm. and I never asked him why he flew that flag. So I've had to kind of come to an understanding. But I think for him, it was a laying of a stake in this country and saying, I served my country, I'm an American, and no one has a right to make me feel less than, even though this country has made him feel less than. So it was an outward display and an outward claim on a country that many black Americans have felt they couldn't make a real claim to.
You also describe another veteran, a guy named Isaac Woodward. He was honorably discharged from the military. He comes home. He's beaten, loses his eyesight as a result of this beating. And as you describe, or perhaps others described him, that uniform that he wore with such great pride was seen as not necessarily patriotic, but as something more dangerous than that.
Yes, it was a signal of a dangerous pride. What is kind of so amazing about the Black American story is Black people have fought in every war that this country has been in, including the Revolutionary War, where the very first person to die for the cause of the revolution was a Black man named Crispus Attucks, a Black and Indigenous man named Crispus Attucks, who is a fugitive from slavery. And so my father joined the military, and like so many men, and Isaac Woodward was one of those men who went to fight for democracy abroad. He fought in World War II and then returned to a country that was violently repressing democracy and rights for black citizens. And white Americans, particularly in the South where most black people lived, saw wearing the uniform as a sign of a pridefulness in an expression of manhood and citizenship that they thought was deeply unsettling to the status quo. And so what we know is black men who were returning in uniform were lynched, they were beaten, they faced a great deal of violence, even higher than the average black person, as a sense that there was a need to put them in their place. And white congressmen were very vocal and explicit about this. They feared that allowing black men to have the dignity of wearing the uniform, of arming black men to fight in wars abroad, of giving black men a chance when they traveled to Europe to fight in the war, of being treated like full Americans, that once those men returned, they were not simply going to quietly go back to their subordinate status. So there was a great deal of fear about these black men who came back pridefully wearing this uniform and a need to send a very violent message that you better get back in your place. And Isaac Woodward was a victim of that. He was wearing his uniform. He had just been discharged from and was on the way to see his wife, whom he hadn't seen for several months because he had been fighting abroad and did not show proper deference and was beaten nearly to death and lost his vision permanently. He also, though, then becomes really a symbol of the burgeoning civil rights movement. And the NAACP takes up his cause and brings him all around the country as a sign of saying, look what you're doing to the men who served and fought for our country. And this is the treatment we have. It is time for black people to be treated as full citizens.
Nicole, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's an award-winning investigative reporter. She covers race and civil rights for the New York Times Magazine, the lead writer for the magazine 1619 Project, which has been in writing about the beginning of our country, which they mark as 1619, for some months now. And it's gotten a lot of response, a lot of enthusiastic response. And as I mentioned, some of the historians have taken an issue with some parts of it. We are talking about Nicole, about both about her own family and also about this history, as she tells in her opening essay. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. As you were talking about your father and also talking about the attack on Isaac Woodward, it does raise questions about where the kind of optimism and even patriotism that the African Americans have felt about this country in spite of what they've been up against.
Yeah, I think it comes down to Black people, because of our experience, an experience of being brutally enslaved under a system of chattel slavery, of having to fight for basic rights of citizenship for 100 years after slavery, of still having to fight now, that there had to be a belief that this country could be forced to live up to its ideals, because otherwise I could only imagine a people who have had to live generationally in despair. This is our country. We have been here for generations. Because of the process of slavery, we have no known, tribal or family ties to another country elsewhere. Our language is English. Our ancestors have been here for generations. So we have to try to make this country work for us. We really don't have a choice. And that has led to a belief that we can fight to make this country's ideals true for us and really for all Americans. I think it is it is the mechanism by which we have been able to survive and really overcome a country where nearly every institution was geared towards subordinating us. So I think that optimism is just inherent in the Black experience, because we had no choice but to believe and have the faith we could change this country for the better.
You call these, you say this, you know, we're perfecting democracy here. We're making it better.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, if you look at the history and the role that Black Americans have played, Black Americans through their centuries-long resistance struggle have been the ones who have most expanded democracy in our country. We were not a democracy at our founding. The majority of Americans did not have access to the franchise. Women could not vote at our founding. Certainly, one-fifth of the population who were enslaved could not vote. And even most white people who did not own land, most white men who didn't own land, could not vote. But Black people actually believed in those founding ideals that our founders wrote down but did not actually think applied to all people, and have fought for what, you know, when you look at the Black rights struggle with the Reconstruction Amendments, with the civil rights laws that get passed in the 1950s and the 1960s, these are the broadest expansion of both voting and citizenship rights that this country has ever seen. And that really has been the primary role that Black Americans have played, is actually bringing us as close to a democracy as we have been. And yet, we are never taught that. We are not taught that that is the role that Black people have played. And Black people have not gotten the credit and I think the proper status when we think about building this democracy that Black people deserve, if you study the history.
Well, this inevitably leads to a discussion of Thomas Jefferson, you know, his lofty and inspiring words about all men being created equal, and the fact that there were something like 130 enslaved people at Monticello, the forced labor camp, as you describe it. I remember being there about 5 years ago, you know, going on the tour. And it was just the beginning of the acknowledgement that there was Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman at Monticello. And it seemed, I think Monticello has done a better job of trying to understand this contradictory and even hypocritical history. But you could see it was being struggled out right there on the site of Monticello.
Yeah, for sure. So I actually just visited Monticello for the first time with my daughter a few weeks ago. My daughter is 9 years old. I'd never been. And they certainly, at least the tour I got, did a pretty decent job of acknowledging the role of slavery and what allowed Thomas Jefferson the wealth and privilege and education to become one of the founders, and that that was built on the forced labor and torture of the enslaved people whom he owned. You know, there was this really profound moment with my daughter. We went to the rear of the house, which is really considered the front of the house. And you can see the fingerprints of the enslaved children in some of the bricks on that house, because as early as 8 or 9 years old, black children on the property were going out to work the property in the nailery and making bricks, as the white children on the property were being privately tutored inside the house. And so my daughter stands next to this brick with these fingerprints of enslaved children. And it was this deeply troubling and moving moment for me to think about that, as Thomas Jefferson is writing these majestic words of universal liberty that will go out to the world to make the case for why we needed to be our own country so that we could be free, that my daughter would have been one of those children in slavery, making the bricks for this beautiful monument that is on our money right now. I think that is a hard thing for Americans to grapple with, which is why, or I should say white Americans, black people don't have a choice but to grapple with that. And that's really why the project exists, is to say, you know, we have gone on a really centuries-long propaganda campaign to downplay the role of slavery, to marginalize it, to pretend it wasn't that big of a deal, because we can't really deal with that hypocrisy of our founding, but we must.
About a minute before our break here, but I do think that exemplifies the contradiction, hypocrisy, the lies, sort of at the founding of this country, that there were these ideals, and then there was the fact of slavery.
Absolutely, and we just need to be honest. You know, we did not have to continue the institution of slavery in this new country. Yes, the British foisted slavery, or as Thomas Jefferson would like to say, foisted slavery upon the colonists. But at the moment of abolition, or at the moment of the revolution, we could have chosen to abolish the institution of slavery, and we did not. And we have to live with that, and we have to deal with the ramifications of that.
Well, let's take that break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Nicole Hannah-Jones, an award-winning investigative reporter. She covers race and civil rights for the New York Times Magazine, lead writer for the 1619 Project of the magazine, a co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting. She's getting an award tomorrow by the Pennsylvania ACLU, and she's a MacArthur Fellow in 2017. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to discuss after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Nicole Hannah-Jones about the New York Times Magazine 1619 Project. It's a collection of essays and criticisms, art about how America was founded actually in 1619 when a ship carrying enslaved Africans landed in Virginia. We'd like to know what you think of that. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Nicole, I am no historian here, but I know some historians have taken issue with one of the things that you wrote in your essay. You seem to be saying that we declared independence from Britain so that we could continue this slavery in this country. Is that your intent?
I don't seem to be saying that. What I write is that one of the primary reasons that we decide to declare our independence was over the institution of slavery. And that is true. If you look at why some of the colonists in South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia who had been reluctant to join the revolution ultimately decide to, it is over our fears that slavery will be abolished and kind of war efforts of the British to offer freedom to enslaved people if they join the cause of the British against the colonists. So while this is a surprising claim to most Americans, mm-hmm. not surprisingly, because you don't get that in your K-12 public history, this work, I did not invent things out of thin air. This is the work of historians who have written about the various motivations of the colonists. One of the other motivations was expanding the desire to expand onto Indian land that the King of England had said were off limits. So there were lots of different motivations that the colonists had, and preserving slavery was indeed one of them. And I think, again, we need to acknowledge the truth. There are certain people who want to kind of protect the purity of our founding, but there were great motivations, the desire for freedom and liberty, opposition to paying taxes, the desire to have representation. But there were also not so great motives, which shouldn't be that surprising if one understands the history of this country.
Well, as you say, the first 12 presidents of the United States were enslavers.
First 10 of the
first 10. First 10 were slavers.
10 of the first 12.
10 of the yeah. first 12.
Yes. And that, you know, again, this is something that we're taught that is kind of incidental. But what that tells you is where power in the country lay. You don't become president if you are not amongst the most powerful people in the country. And it is not incidental that 10 of our first 12 presidents were enslavers, and the only two who weren't were named Adams. We need to reckon with that. George Washington owned hundreds of people. Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, you know, the drafter of the Constitution. These were men who got their power and wealth from slavery. So it should not be surprising to us that slavery would have played a role in the revolution.
Fair enough. Here's an email from Paul. He says, in my opinion, our school systems have failed to teach this part of history of this country and its people adequately. And I'm sure you agree with him. I'm curious even about how schools and universities and colleges have responded to this 1619 Project as a way to incorporate this history and better understand it.
Yeah. Our schools have done a terrible job of teaching this history, and that's because when you understand the role of the American history that we learn in our K-12 education, it's really about creating a shared sense of national identity and putting forth a certain narrative about America, which is this narrative of exceptionality and that we are a country that was always making forward progress. And so dealing with slavery really complicates that narrative. So we don't learn very much about it at all. One of the most, I think, amazing and fulfilling parts, though, of the 1619 Project and what has come since it published is the way that educators have embraced teaching this as a supplement to the history that we already learn. So we know that the 1619 Project, we partnered with the Pulitzer Center to create a free curriculum, and educators in every state in America are teaching the 1619 Project. And there are several school districts that have mandated it to be taught in every high school in their
wow.
district.
Wow.
Colleges across the country are teaching it in history and sociology, in English courses. And I think, again, that was unexpected, kind of the way that educators would really come to this project and want to teach it. But I really hope that what it does, and again, we're not arguing that this is the only way to learn the American story and this is the only history. But I think as a supplement to force us to kind of question the way we've been taught to think about our country. And for those who haven't read the project, I think mm-hmm. it's also important to point out the 1619 Project is not really a history. It is about the ongoing legacy of slavery. So every essay in the project actually starts with a modern American institution or phenomena and traces back its roots to slavery to show that we're not just talking about something that ended 150 years ago. We're talking about something whose legacy we still are grappling with in modern America.
In fact, I've been very moved, frankly, by what you and others have written here. But you also talk about, and it's important to understand the kind of psychological, for lack of a better word, or even scientific investment in this idea, this doctrine of Black inferiority, and how much that has been so much a part of our history.
Yes. Yeah, so what happens at, particularly after the period of the revolution, is we as a nation have to psychically and psychologically justify how we can be a country founded on the inalienable, God-given, universal rights of mankind, and yet enslave one-fifth of our population and hold them in absolute bondage. And the way that we justify that is saying that Black people are not fully human. Mm. Black people are an inferior subgroup, and as a result, they don't require the protections of the Constitution. And therefore, we are not being hypocritical because we, the people, only counts if you are a full person and a citizen. And it's really remarkable the way that this narrative of Black inferiority that is needed to justify not just those who engage in slavery, but an entire country that allows the institution of slavery and that profits from the institution of slavery to justify it. And so in science, in literature, certainly in our legal system, we see this in our medical system, we see this justification of Black inferiority, which makes us say slavery's not so bad because Black people aren't as smart as us. Black people don't love their children the same as us. They don't feel pain the way that we feel. So when we whip them and beat them, it's no different than whipping or beating a horse or a cow. And once slavery ends, you can't just flip the script and say, well, now they're fully human just like we are. You have to carry on that lie that justified slavery. And we're still grappling with that today. We see across aspects of American life this belief that Black people are culturally, intellectually, physiologically inferior to white Americans. And we have not been able to purge that from our national psyche.
Well, let me pick up on something you just said, because you write after the Civil War, the expectation was that Black people would exact some kind of revenge on white enslavers. And as you write, in fact, the opposite happened. It was the creation of public schools and voting rights and the numbers of Black officials, for instance, who served in state legislatures in the South.
Yes. So what's clear is one of the ways we justify in modern society that we were a slaveocracy at our founding is that we really kind of argue that they didn't know slavery was wrong back then, that white Americans, that white people who allowed slavery didn't know it was wrong. But that's not true. I mean, you can look at Thomas Jefferson's own writings, and he's deeply conflicted about the immorality of human bondage. And so what we know then is that understanding that what they did was deeply wrong, that at the end of slavery, there is this fear, particularly in places across the South where Black people were the majority, there was this fear that, oh, now that they have gained their freedom and their rights, they're going to seek vengeance for all of the terrible and brutal things that we did to them. But it wasn't true, because as I write in my piece, there is something about never having had freedom that makes you value freedom more than anyone else. And when Black people, for this brief period during Reconstruction, formerly enslaved people, go into governance, instead of trying to punish white people for what they had done, they actually seek to expand opportunity and rights and a common good for all people. So it is in these biracial legislatures that we see public education for the first time in the South. We see progressive taxation for the first time in the South. We see large expenditures going into kind of public works programs that benefit the common good. Because Black folks understand, because of our unique experience, that simply working in service of the individual was never going to work for us, because our fates were always going to be tied to other people. Unfortunately, that period of Reconstruction, this very brief experiment with biracial governance only lasted 12 years. And then the South is redeemed in the name of national reunification. And Black people are forced out of elected office, deprived of the franchise, and would not really get it back again for 100 years.
You know, as I was reading your essay, I was thinking of a trip I took to Germany a couple of years ago. I went to Auschwitz, went to a number of museums in Berlin that dealt with the Nazi Holocaust, the outrageous and extreme treatment of Jews and others in that country. And it seemed like that was a country that at least has been grappling with its past, its more recent past. But nonetheless, are we grappling with this past of ours?
No, we're not grappling with it very well at all. I mean, if you want to bring up the example of Auschwitz, the places we call plantations here in the United States were in fact slave labor camps. They existed to force Black people to labor as slaves for profit. And yet people go and get married on these plantations. Some people can choose to rent and stay in a slave cabin for a night. You would never see that at a place like Auschwitz. We wouldn't say that, well, some of the buildings are really beautiful. Mm. And, you know, it reminds us of a certain mystic time. You would never say that about a concentration camp in Germany. And yet here, we want to really whitewash the brutality, the rape, the torture that went on those places that we call plantations. And so part of that whitewashing is to simply pretend they were just part of a gauzy antebellum era that reminds us of Gone with the Wind. So we can't even grapple with this in basic ways. You don't go to Germany and, for instance, see statues to Hitler the Nazis. And yet all across the South, Black people's tax dollars are paying to maintain monuments to the people who fought to keep them in slavery. Children are going into schools named after Confederate generals who owned their ancestors and fought to preserve a system of slavery. They are going, you can go to, buildings at Harvard or Yale and see buildings that were built and named after people who made their money in part off of slavery. So Germany, in many ways, is far ahead of us on reckoning, and we have a very long way to go.
We have a couple of minutes here, and the question that sort of hangs over this conversation is what does America owe Black Americans? What do we owe?
I think you cannot read the 1619 Project from front to back and not come away feeling that a profound debt is due. I think it should be clear that, again, the argument that we're making is not just about slavery, but the ongoing legacy. You know, my father was born into apartheid Mississippi, where Black people did not have rights of citizenship. My grandmother could not vote until she left the South. They could not use a public library. There were jobs that were off limits to Black people simply because they were Black. And if you look today, across every indicator that you measure, the Black poverty rate is three times that of white Americans. The Black wealth is one-tenth that of white Americans. Highest rates of incarceration, highest rates of infant mortality. Everything that you measure, Black people remain at the bottom. And that is a tangible legacy of slavery. And this nation has never offered a true redress to what has happened. And what I hope that people who actually engage with the project with an open mind will see is that our inability to deal with our anti-Black racism that develops to justify slavery hurts all Americans. It's not good for America to have your largest racial minority living with one-third of people in poverty and unable to have the wealth to send their kids to college or to purchase home. That actually hurts our entire country. And we need to make restitution for what was done.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you for the 1619 Project as well.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. She's an award-winning investigative reporter, and she does cover race and civil rights for the New York Times Magazine, and she is the creator of the magazine 1619 Project. And she's going to be receiving an award tomorrow from the Pennsylvania ACLU. It's the We the People Award. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.